Hello, everyone, and welcome to Heard on the Street, Street Fights podcast, where we uncover the stories behind the companies and, more importantly, the strategies they're demonstrating today. So what are their challenges and best practices, and what can we all learn from that? So I'm Mike Boland, lead analyst at Street Fight, and our guest today is Benoit Grouchko, who is CEO of Temo, which is a location-relevant marketing platform for retailers and brick-and-mortar businesses. So Benoit, welcome to the program.
Hello.
So we actually have a lot to talk about, including diving deeper into everything I just mentioned. But first, let's start with a quick intro for you and your company, for those unfamiliar.
Thank you, Mike. And so I'm Benoit Grouchko. I'm CEO and one of the co-founders of Temo. So just a few words about Temo, which is a marketing platform for the brick and mortar world. We basically help retailers, groceries, restaurants drive more traffic and sales into their stores with the best performance.
That's great. And there's a lot we can unpack there and talk about, particularly these days, where a theme we often talk about at Street Fight is the sheer volume of transactions and consumer spending that happens offline as opposed to e-commerce. But of course, we have mobile devices and we have increasing influence from these digital media that drive us offline. So it's that, like, the art of connecting those dots, which it seems like you guys are doing some very interesting things there. So one thing we often like to talk about with our guests before we go into the product itself, from a company perspective, tell us a little bit about the founding story for Temo.
So the first lesson, I don't know if I'd call it a lesson, but the first story I would share is about the founding itself. Mm-hmm. And that was a really tough decision, to be honest, because Credo is such an amazing company and I was doing great over there. And so nothing was incentivizing me to leave and to take that ridiculous risk of founding a company. And what actually triggered that decision was here is how I thought about it. We had an amazing team, very complimentary, great people. We saw a big problem. We thought we had a real opportunity to solve that problem, and there was, you know, there was nothing really existential that was preventing us from starting the company. You know, like, sort of, I didn't have children yet at this time, or yep. You know, a huge mortgage or whatever. And so what I thought was, like, all right, if I'm not doing this now, like, sort of, there's always going to be a good reason not to do it. Mm-hmm. So as soon as I had that in mind, nothing could stop me from doing it, actually.
Yeah, that's great.
So that's how we, you know, jumped in. And then I think, you know, as often, we realized that what we had in mind, we had to slightly adjust the product, the market fit, the pitch, and all that stuff. And so we had a few, you know, we made lots of adjustments there. And I think that period was absolutely critical because we found a few different positionings, and I think you need to iterate really quickly in those phases because you need to really think both, you know, high level and also low level in terms of, all right, is this working? And then taking a step back, like, sort of, where is this going? What's the opportunity? How is it scalable? And all that stuff. And I think that's how we came into where we are now, really. And this is the phase where you need to be very careful about what you're doing, what you want to build, where you want to go with your company. Mm-hmm.
That's great. And you mentioned the pitch. Sticking with this theme of early day lessons before we move on to kind of a product discussion, another thing along these lines we often like to ask our guests is the process of raising capital, because I did notice that you have funding from some top-tier firms like Index Ventures. So what are some of the lessons there? That's always a hot topic and valuable learnings in terms of you know, lessons in securing funding and the process itself. So what was that like for you?
So, yeah, you're right. We're very lucky to have such amazing investors who are providing lots of help and support on a daily basis. I think, you know, there's a lot of talking about VC and fundraising in general because it's absolutely critical in startup life in general. Mm-hmm. I think the first question is, do you need VC money, right? Or it's not really a do you need VC money, but should you raise VC money?
Yeah.
And I think that's that's the first and that's the biggest question, and that kind of solves it all, because the point is it really depends on the company. It really depends on the opportunity you're after, and about what you're going to do with that money. So obviously, it's amazing to convince such, you know, prestigious and wise investors and get lots of money on the bank account. But at the end, the question is really, all right, with that money, what are you going to do? How is this going to help you grow faster and generate more value than what you would do without it? And, you know, if you think about this way, it really comes down to what's the plan you're going to build with that money, how it's going to help you accelerate, differentiate, and all that stuff. And I think this is really the right way to look at that. Like, raising money is not an end in itself.
Yeah.
It's just a way to get there.
I think that's wise advice. And, you know, I'm here in Silicon Valley where it's almost a cultural vanity factor to receive funding. So often that question of why, or if, I think is the right question, whether or not you do it, is one that people often skip. And I think it probably has a lot to do with several factors that would fill their own podcast, such as, you know, a rapid growth model versus a slow growth model. And if you need to grab market share quickly, or if you're kind of waiting for a market to arrive where a slow growth bootstrap model might make more sense. But I think some of those key factors all start with that key question of if. So I think that's very wise advice. So we're actually going to pause for a commercial break. When we come back, more from Timo. Hi, everyone. This is Mike Bolin, lead analyst with Street Fight, and I'd like to talk to you today about Street Fight in 2019. So we've got lots of good things cooking and lots of opportunities for you to get involved. So we're looking for guests on this podcast. We're looking for editorial contributions from thought leaders. We're looking for inspiring speakers at our events. And all of that really comes together in the rich mosaic that you've come to know as Street Fight's thought leadership in location-based media and advertising and commerce and innovation. And part of that formula are lots of opportunities to sponsor content and have your brand associated with that thought leadership. So stay tuned for lots more information and announcements for those rollouts, and reach out to us if you have any questions or want your voice heard in that chorus of narratives, including this podcast and messages like this one. So you can email me at michael@streetfightmag.com for more, and we're looking forward to working with you in 2019. So we're back. My guest is Benoit Grouchko. So Benoit, before the break, we were talking a lot about your background, the company's founding. So now let's go one level deeper into Timo itself. So you call it a drive to store marketing platform in some of your marketing materials. So tell us more about what you mean by that and the value proposition and some of the points of differentiation in doing what we talked about earlier, which is to drive and measure that offline commerce component.
So, you know, if you think about whenever anyone makes an investment, what they're looking for is a return on investment. And obviously, advertising is no exception to that. When you look at the retail or groceries or restaurants industries in particular, or also the auto industry to some extent, the vast majority of the business happens in physical locations. And so, and all those investments that they're doing in marketing, it's in order to drive, you know, store traffic and store sales. So we call it a drive-to-store marketing platform because we've really built the whole platform to maximize that KPI. It's really about driving as many incremental visits as possible, because we believe that this is really the most critical indicator that retailers look at when it comes to advertising. Mm-hmm. And in terms of positioning, so it's quite simple. We want to deliver the best performance. We need to have the, you know, the best ROI, the best metrics. And then obviously advertisers need scale, because if you want to be strategic, if a partner can be considered as a strategic partner for a retailer, it needs to have sufficient scale so it can make a difference and really matter to their business. So the way we do that is really thanks to data and technology.
That's great. So to kind of drill down one level into kind of what that looks like, what is the particular data sets that you are collecting in how you're driving that offline consumer behavior? How are you packaging that and providing it to retailers? What form does that data take? Are you talking about sort of a visitation rate of some sort? And perhaps to kind of tell that story as a corollary, I'd also love to hear about some of the specific brands, retailers and brands that you're working with and kind of how you're serving them and the value they're getting out of it.
Yeah. So first, to start with the product, we actually leverage different kinds of data. In the end, it's really about, all right, what data can help me get better performance, right? Whatever kind of data it is. But when it comes to driving performance in the physical world, there's clearly one set of data that makes a huge difference. It's location data, because location data is what helps you understand the physical profile of a given user. So we use a lot of location data at different levels of granularity, and that's really something that can help us a lot, targeting the right people and making sure we have the most personalized and relevant experience for each of them. But then we can also use some social demo data or some behavioral and interest data. So anything really that can help us deliver better performance. And then you mentioned who we're working with and some examples. So for instance, we've had a very nice case study with Joann Stores, the arts and crafts retailers. Really, the problem that they had, so they're a pretty typical physical retailer. Most of their business is happening offline, and so they really had a challenge of, all right, how can I have a direct impact on my bottom line? How can I drive more traffic and sales in my stores? And so they went through a pretty thorough process of identifying the different solutions, programs that could help them achieve that goal. And actually, what they realized is that we were by far the platform that would deliver incremental margin and sales in store. So that's really why they decided to double down with us.
That's great. And then any kind of success metrics from that case study or any others in terms of, tangible results that you've been able to prove for your retail clients?
Yes, absolutely. And the metrics that we're looking at and that the market is mostly looking at is really incremental visits. So, if you've done a program there, how many visits on top of, incremental visits you got in your stores thanks to it? And we usually see, it depends from one program to another, but we usually see incrementality rates from 5 to 10%, which is quite significant.
And that's measured against some sort of control group or benchmark from, non location-based advertising or pre your platform.
Yes, exactly. So what you do is that you're gonna have a target, group of people, and you're gonna split that group in two. You're gonna expose some of them with the solution, and you're not gonna show any advertising to the other one, and you're gonna see how many visits you generate in each group, how many visits are generated in each group, and the difference allows you to tell exactly, for that specific program, the impact that it had. So actually, the way the market is structured is we're working out with measurement partners who are actually doing that for the advertiser as an independent player.
That's great. And I think it seems that you're also putting your money with your where your mouth is in terms of this, effectiveness of driving value through store visitations. I believe that that metric defines how you get paid by your retail partners, correct? In terms of like a revenue model.
Yeah, absolutely. So, in the end, if you want something that is scalable, that is sustainable, advertisers really need to see the return on investment, right? And so if they don't get the right ROI, if they're not able to know what they're paying for and that it makes sense for them, it's going to be hard to, to really scale that business. So that's why, in the end, what really matters to us and to our customers is how many incremental visits we drive, and that's, everything is tied to that.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Now, how about the data itself? You mentioned at a high level some of the sources of data, in terms of whether it be kind of social signals or other location tracking signals. How are you kind of getting that, and what are the partnerships you're forming to do that? Is it kind of at the app layer, or how are you bringing together that valuable data and then processing it into insights?
Yeah, we're working exactly. We're working with mobile applications in order to collect location and behavioral data. And so all of that is tied to, the advertising idea. And that's how we build our profiles and then know how to target the most relevant users. So, based on the area someone lives, the area someone works, the apps someone uses, and all those things. You can actually, the stores that someone visits, obviously, that's very interesting. And that can tell you, all right, like for that, for Joanne, all right, I really need to target people who've been to those kinds of locations and who live in those areas, etc. And that's how we can get much better performance.
Yeah, that makes sense. Now, you mentioned Joann, which of course is a fabrics retailer. Earlier, you mentioned autos as well. How does all of this map to different verticals? Are there specific verticals or, types of products and shopping patterns that are conducive to your program, such as, shopper frequency or any other metrics? Or do you consider it more of a kind of horizontal play in having broad applicability? And as a corollary to all of that, are there what you believe to be untapped areas in terms of other verticals you're interested in moving into?
So, there's two ways of looking at this, right? To some extent, we're clearly a specialist because we only, our platform really makes a difference for brick and mortar players, and so in particular, like restaurants, groceries, retail, auto. So, all the others, we're not making that much of a difference to them. So, to some extent, these are the verticals that we're looking after, and I wouldn't consider us as a horizontal player.
Okay.
And within those verticals, obviously the products are going to be quite different, right? But it's different, and at the same time, it's really about the same end goal, which is driving people into stores. Then there's all the verticals that we're exploring, and to be very honest, right now, it's not the biggest part of our business, but I believe there's great opportunities there. You can think about, like, telcos, for instance,
Oh,
or
yeah.
banks. Anything that has really a physical presence, right? So it can be retail, it can be housing things. So, these are things that we expect to grow over time for sure.
Yeah, and it seems like there's so many variables there, such as, the cycle of the product itself. Like you mentioned, telcos, and their, physical locations. If people are buying cell phones, that might be an every 2 year purchase, but it's a very high value purchase. So it seems like the value that different types of retailers place on that data and that value that you're driving to them could be a function of, the margins that they see as a result. Like with autos, you mentioned autos, that's, obviously a very high value purchase, so they place a great deal of value in those kind of leads and that foot traffic. So that's very interesting. So we're actually going to pause there for another commercial break. When we come back, more from Benoit. Hi everyone, this is Mike Bolin, lead analyst with Street Fight, and I'd like to talk to you today about Street Fight in 2019. So we've got lots of good things cooking and lots of opportunities for you to get involved. So we're looking for guests on this podcast. We're looking for editorial contributions from thought leaders. We're looking for inspiring speakers at our events. And all of that really comes together in the rich mosaic that you've come to know as Street Fight's thought leadership in location-based media and advertising and commerce and innovation. And part of that formula are lots of opportunities to sponsor content and have your brand associated with that thought leadership. So stay tuned for lots more information and announcements for those rollouts, and reach out to us if you have any questions or want your voice heard in that chorus of narratives, including this podcast and messages like this one. So you can email me at michael@streetfightmag.com for more, and we're looking forward to working with you in 2019. So we're back. My guest is Benoit Grochko. So Benoit, before the break, we were talking a lot about the product, the ins and outs, how you are collecting data, how you are synthesizing that data and providing it to your retail partners in terms of driving foot traffic and also proving that through store visitation metrics. So part of all of that is of course a key component that is that resonates a lot today, which is privacy, especially if we're talking about anything location based. Privacy is always a component. So you being a company based in Europe, that's of course where privacy is equally, if not more, pronounced as a topic and as a component, and GDPR is of course a big part of that. And I've heard that you are actually the first company to become GDPR compliant. So as you know, talking about that, and also as a lead into your overall feelings and philosophies as a company about responsible data collection and privacy sensitivity.
Yeah. So maybe just to talk about the GDPR compliance thing. That was last year, 2 years after GDPR came into force. In July, the French Data Protection Authority reached out to us to actually define the new rules of the location-based advertising ecosystem for Europe. And so we had several discussions with them, which led to the new framework being put in place. And as a consequence, we were officially announced as being the first company to be GDPR compliant in France and in Europe. So
did you get some sort of award or something to put on the wall?
You know,
just paperwork.
Paperwork. And I think I would put it more like sort of we were glad to have that whole thing over. And yep. So, you know, we could reassure the whole market that what we do was totally compliant and that everyone could think long term. So actually, it's been a great opportunity for us in the long term because it's very reassuring for the whole ecosystem to know that they can think long term with us.
Absolutely.
And so in terms of how we consider privacy, I would say that we're definitely a privacy first company, and privacy is at the core of our DNA. It's really what actually GDPR calls as privacy by design. So everything you do, any product that you build, you need to think about it from a privacy standpoint and have a privacy strategy around that. So I would say our philosophy around this is quite straightforward. I believe, and at Timo, we believe that users need control and transparency over the data. So they need to know what kind of data is being collected, who it is being used by, what it is being used for, and they need to have control over all of that to, you know, opt out if they want to opt out, get their data deleted if they want their data to be deleted, have the right access, etc.
Absolutely. And, you know, I'm here in California where California's kind of pending, looming legislation is following closely behind GDPR, and California being the state that has probably the most kind of progressive stance towards consumer advocacy and other issues is really leading the way here in the states. And one thing that is interesting about California is it's such a large market that we believe that many of the companies that are in the advertising and ad tech space are going to have to adopt the California legislation essentially across the board so that they're not having to, you know, perform two different sets of practices for California and then everywhere else. They'll have to make California essentially the standard across the board based on the gravitational pull and the size of the market. So I think it's really going to push things in that direction here in the States. So that's, I guess, a lead into a question about your geographic coverage. Earlier we talked about the verticals you're covering. What does your geographic coverage look like and any, you know, expansion on the horizon that you can talk about?
So just to get back to California and privacy, so I fully agree with you. I think with everything that happened, some privacy regulations are going to come into play in the US. And I think CCPA is definitely paving the way, and I wouldn't be surprised that the rest would fall in line.
Yep.
And as far as we're concerned, We're applying the similar principles to GDPR in the US.
Yeah.
So I think we're kind of
You're
ahead
already
of that.
ahead then.
Exactly. And I think that's really important because it's potentially going to restructure the market, right? We've only been in the US for a bit more than a year now, and we're seeing great traction now. We have, you know, more than a dozen customers that are scaling, and we really want to scale and think long term. And so I think keeping users' trust is critical for the sustainability and the sake of the ecosystem. And for that, they need to be comfortable with what's going on with their data. So this is really how we see that.
Yeah, it would also seem like European companies that are operating in the United States may have an advantage in terms of instilling that trust because they are automatically GDP compliant by definition. So that like mark of approval here in the States probably carries some weight, more so than, you know, perhaps just any given average kind of data collection company that is based here.
Yeah, it's very reassuring for advertisers, and I think it's reassuring because, you know, we've been through it in Europe, so we're very familiar with those topics, and it's really been integrated at all levels in the company.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's great. So let's now move into our lightning round. So this is our just kind of fun set of questions to find out a little bit more about you. So jumping right into it, what's something about you that few people know about?
So probably one thing is I can speak 7 languages, which is quite unusual.
Yeah.
And so I speak French, I speak a little bit English, some Spanish, some Portuguese, some German, mm-hmm. some Russian, and a little bit of Italian.
Yeah. Well, that's impressive because that's a mix of, you know, Romance languages with also, you know, other, you know, derivations of language, Slavic and others. So that's, you know, that's not as easy as going from, you know, like Italian to French, you know, if you're going to Russian and others like that. So that's very impressive. So what's the profession you'd want to have if you weren't doing what you do now?
Well, clearly, I would say probably a mix of dad at home and world traveler.
That's a good one. We haven't heard that yet, and that sounds like a fun, enviable position. You know, being in the tech world, what's another tech company or startup, either current or throughout history, that you think it would be most exciting to be a part of at early stages?
I think the ones that have been or that still are actually at the foundations of the digital economy. Mm-hmm. So, you know, being at Apple in the early days, that's a while ago, right? But I think that must have been like so incredible.
Huh.
And likewise, when you think about like being at Netscape or being at Google, right? Like you really, it's so crazy what you're building and what you're bringing to the world. It must be a very, very exciting experience and unique.
Yeah, I like the Netscape answer. Because that's a unique answer in terms of this question on this show. But also, I believe that they're kind of one of the unsung heroes of tech history in basically launching the browser. And absolutely, that's great. So what is your favorite tech product or app that you use as a consumer?
So I think I'm a big fan of mountaineering, actually.
Oh,
and
nice.
So I think the ones that I have a lot of, I enjoy using a lot, are, you know, all those topographic map with location in it. This is so convenient to, you know where you are, know where you go, and it's usually very handy. So I really like those. I would say another one, maybe the one that struck me the most when I discovered it is Google Earth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's the kind of thing that I'm not using it as a consumer, right? I don't know if many consumers use it that much, but you know, when you discover that thing, it's such a jewel, right?
Oh, absolutely. And Google Earth, you may have seen over the last year, has been developing their port over to the HTC Vive for a VR experience, which is just that much more immersive. And I believe that's going to be an area of exciting developments for Google Earth. Who is someone from the business world that you most admire?
I think the ones that I admire the most are the visionaries and the leaders. So, you know, the usual suspects, obviously, but, you know, when you look at When you look at a pitch from Steve Jobs, you know, it's really unique, right? And there's so much you can learn out of that. But also the great leaders, like, you know, someone like Eric Schmidt, or you know, the former CEO of Intel, those kind of people are, I think, really, you can learn so much from them.
Yeah. One thing that I like about the names that you mentioned, you know, Eric Schmidt, you know, throughout Intel's history, all kinds of people, Robert Noyce, Andy Grove, qualities that blend both business savvy, but also technological and engineering savvy. And bringing those two things together, I think, is such a unique mix and a great answer. So finally, what are some of the kind of passions or hobbies that help you mentally unplug from work? You mentioned mountaineering. You could go with that answer and tell us a little bit more about it, or anything else you want to mention.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of rock climbing, actually. So this is one of my passions, and you know, I wish I could do more. But so rock climbing, skiing, really mountain stuff.
Lastly, what are some of your personal goals for the remainder of the year?
So there's a few. I think one of them is making sure I have the right balance between my professional and my personal life. And I think that's really important for my family. And I think, obviously, you know, another one is ensuring we have continued success for Timo, and that you know, we scale our business in the US, where we've had a very strong head start, and we also keep growing in Europe, obviously. I think if I manage to do those two well, I'll be happy about 2019.
That's great, and that's a great place to end it. So that's all the time we have. So I want to thank you, Benoit, for spending time with us.
Thank you, Mike.
Yes, and thank you all for listening, and stay tuned for future episodes of Heard on the Street. You can find us on streetfightmag.com, subscribe on Apple Podcasts, and also stay tuned for lots more writings and multimedia from Street Fight. So this has been Heard on the Street. I'm Mike Boland. Thanks for listening.